The sport is changing. The deal that happened yesterday, sorry I'm not wearing my mask, but I wanted to show whoever it was that you're not going to take away my smile, and I'm going to keep on going.
That was NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace, who finished in 14th place at yesterday's race at Talladega, less than 24 hours after a noose was discovered in his team's garage. Wallace, who was NASCAR's only black driver, was instrumental in prompting NASCAR's leadership to ban the Confederate flag from their events. Today, ESPN's Ryan McGee fills us in on the investigation to find the perpetrator behind this crime, then explains how Wallace is using his voice to speak out on racial injustice and to lead his sport through an overdue culture change. I'm Ina Kimes. It's Tuesday, June 23rd. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Ina Kimes.
Ryan McGee covers NASCAR for ESPN. So, Ryan, it has been a tumultuous 24 hours in NASCAR. Late Sunday afternoon, we received this horrifying news that a noose was discovered in the garage of Bubba Wallace, who was NASCAR's only black driver. Last time you were with us, you broke down how Wallace was a key voice in pressuring NASCAR to ban Confederate flags from events. But on Sunday at Talladega, the stars and bars were on prominent display outside the race. A plane even flew overhead, towing the flag behind it. Sunday's race ended up being postponed due to weather, so it was run yesterday. What was the scene like there?
The scene was something like I've never seen before, heard of, thought I would ever see in 25 years of covering NASCAR. I had received several texts on Monday morning as race car drivers were starting to wake up in their motor coaches at the infield of the Talladega Super Speedway, and they were learning about what had happened because the release went out from NASCAR almost 11 o'clock p.m. Eastern on Sunday night. And so a lot of drivers were discovering this on Monday morning, and immediately what they were telling me was, we are planning something. And the drivers, just so you know, there's only 40 of them in the Cup Series, and there is a group text amongst the drivers, and you know, they don't have a union, but they do have a group text. And so that group text started Sunday night, and then on Monday morning, that said, all right, when we finally start this rain delayed race on Monday, what are we going to do? And what they did was visually one of the most stunning things I've seen in all my years of covering the sport. All 39 of Bubba Wallace's competitors, friends, colleagues, the other race car drivers circled around the number 43 car after they had pushed it to the front of the grid for the pre-race ceremonies. It was stunning.
What has NASCAR, the official organization, said and done?
Well, they made this public. And the reality is, Mina, they could have very easily just swept it under the rug. This was discovered late in the afternoon on a day that was a washout at the racetrack at an event where all of the teams have been separated and kept very small. And they call them pods that they're working in because of the pandemic restrictions that have been placed on the teams. And a crew member discovered this. He took it to NASCAR security. Bubba Wallace never saw it. Bubba Wallace was informed of this by the president of NASCAR, Steve Phelps. And Steve Phelps held a meeting with his executive team on Sunday evening and said, what do we do with this? And everyone that was in that meeting that I've talked to, and I've talked to several of them, said they never hesitated. We're going to go public with it. And the reason is because they're trying to send a message. Number one, they're not going to deal with this, and they support Bubba Wallace. And number two, they're trying to smoke out the person who did it. And so NASCAR could have very easily, and I would argue that all previous administrations before Steve Phelps would have tried to make this disappear. But instead, they leaned into it, and they did so with their fists clenched.
And when you say smoke them out, it's not NASCAR that's doing that, because this is now in the hands of the government, correct?
Yeah, it's NASCAR cooperating with the FBI. and with investigators of the local law enforcement units there in the Talladega, Alabama area. And the governor of Alabama, she has stated that the state will put their full weight into this. So here's the thing, but because of the pandemic restrictions, every team was limited to 16 people. Guy explained this to you on this podcast weeks ago. There are very specific lanes everyone can walk in and they can work in. They're keeping track of where everyone is all the time. And so as a result, there's only about 900 people that are allowed in the garage. So this is how not smart this person was. Not only what they did was dumb, how they went about it and when they decided to do it was idiotic. Because typically, if it's a normal Talladega Super Speedway race, there are thousands of people in the garage and thousands of people on pit road, fans who paid money to receive tours and sponsors and everyone else. And this is a very small, tight group of people between NASCAR competitors, the people the racetrack has hired to be on the safety crew and for security, and just the racetrack personnel themselves. So it probably isn't going to be very difficult to figure out who this is.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is it would have to be someone with a certain level of clearance that enabled them to get in.
Yes. And I use easy as a relative term. I'm not the FBI agent or the NASCAR executive that has to do this seeking, but it certainly is much easier and a much smaller pool of people who have all been checked, who all had to fill out medical forms to be in the track. There's never been a time when everyone in the garage was as tied to paperwork and have had to be as responsible as this group has for accountability as to where they've been, where they went to dinner, where they slept. I mean, all those things. And so it was not great timing by this not criminal mastermind.
Well, so while this appears to have been some sort of inside job, externally, as I mentioned earlier, there are Confederate flags on display at Talladega. Are you surprised by that?
No. And I've predicted it. I mean, the line I've used with everyone since I wrote my column about the Confederate flag, 2 weeks ago was, you know, what's a rebel going to do when you tell them they can't do something? They're going to rebel. And we've seen this in other places. You know, at Clemson University, they had a Black Lives Matter rally on campus led by the football team. And the scene was almost exactly the same that we saw at Talladega, which was just a parade of pickup trucks with giant Confederate flags flying on the back of it. And perhaps it's just because of where I live. I see those guys all the time. And I knew they would line up and try to protest, but they weren't on the grounds. And this one guy or man or woman paid probably, per my research, paid as much as $3,000 or $4,000 to fly that Confederate flag behind an airplane that's a defund NASCAR. But this was 100% predictable. There was never any question whether it was going to be protests. And NASCAR knew that. NASCAR is now, I've talked to Steve Phelps, president of NASCAR, about it. They've received death threats. They knew the protests were coming. They know they aren't going to go anywhere for a while, but they also are ready for the fight.
How do they handle it? I mean, we talked about how they're handling this particular case, this investigation, but Ryan, what you're describing goes so far beyond, you know, one person, one bad actor. It's cultural, really.
The fact that you say it's cultural, that's the fight they're having, because there's no question it was cultural in the 1940s, late 1940s after NASCAR was founded, in the 50s and the 60s and in the 70s. It's not cultural within the garage now. And so what NASCAR's job to do is to let everyone know that is not cultural within the garage. And it was at one time. I say this half jokingly. I've said it for years. The NASCAR Hall of Fame is a beautiful facility. The diversity display case is very small, but they're trying to fix that. Certainly this administration, Steve Phelps has been in the job less than 2 years, and you're trying to undo an image and also undo this culture. The people who are flying that flag and displaying that flag, they're going to push back like they always have. But the reality is that the push forward is the strongest it's ever been.
So from a business perspective, if, as you described, it's possible that we're talking about a vocal minority, NASCAR might not actually suffer financially from this stand they're taking. In fact, it might be necessary for the sport to grow in the future at all.
Marty Smith and I have been screaming from the rooftops ever since this Confederate flag ban was officially handed down by NASCAR is never once have they told anyone they can't come to a race. They're just saying to you old school redneck who wants to bring us stars and bars, you can't do that. you can come to the race. And they're not closing the door to anyone. They're opening the door to more people. We had Brad Daugherty on our Marty McGee radio show for almost an hour. And Brad grew up in the mountains of North Carolina, a gigantic NASCAR fan, like literally physically the most gigantic NASCAR fan. He wore 43 in the NBA because he loved Richard Petty so much, and he co-owns a NASCAR team now. And he's had difficulty recruiting sponsorship for his race team. Bubba Wallace has had difficulty recruiting sponsorship for himself because Black-owned businesses have looked at them and said, why in the world would we want to be involved there? Look at the flag. And now the enthusiasm you hear in Brad Daugherty's voice and the enthusiasm you hear in Bubba Wallace's voice when they talk about what you're talking about, which is the long-term financial gain and the long-term exposure of this will be a win for NASCAR. They just have to weather the short-term blowback.
I think it's important to stress we're not only talking about loud mouths on Twitter. We're talking about a noose found inside a garage where Bubba Wallace was working. And Ryan, that's terrifying. I mean, how is NASCAR protecting him?
Well, there has been an increased security around Bubba anyway. And that certainly is only going to be dialed up, I believe, as we head into the second half of summer and the fall when more and more race fans return. The Talladega race was the first race with fans in the stands. There were 5,000 fans allowed to be in attendance. As more people return to the track, I believe that Bubba will more than likely receive more security. And I think the visual of the other race car drivers forming a circle around Bubba Wallace after they have pushed his car to the front of that grid during the pre-race at Talladega, that's a man that has added security, both literally and figuratively, and has it everywhere he goes, whether he's in the garage or whether he's just at home on the weekend.
All right, after the break, let's talk a bit more about Bubba's story and everything you know about him. We're presented by Marathon. Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we're aware travel may not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop into the car to run an errand. Or maybe you just want to drive to see your best friend, simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's also quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. Three, two, Ryan.
Go, Ryan, that's your go.
All right. So, Ryan, as we've discussed, you have profiled Bubba for ESPN. You've been around him a long time. What have you heard from him or his camp since all of this began?
The message has been, don't worry about me. I can handle this. And, you know, it goes back to what we've talked about before, which is this is a young man who, unfortunately, he certainly has experienced his share of this inequality that we're all talking about and people are protesting over. And it goes back to when he was 9 years old and he had a cousin that was shot and killed by an officer of the Knoxville Police Department in Tennessee in a very controversial way. And it was court case after court case. And his mother was a protester, was very active and continues to be very active in Black Lives Matter. And it has its roots in that moment. And then Bubba, after he'd won his first national touring NASCAR event, he bought a brand new tricked out Jeep. And he was driving somewhere in Virginia on his way to another racetrack and was pulled over because he failed to give a turn signal while changing lanes. And within minutes, there were multiple squad cars and multiple canine dogs in his Jeep searching for drugs. For no reason other than this is a young black kid who had a way too expensive vehicle in the eyes of these police officers. So he's never really talked about that a lot publicly. He did with me for ESPN the magazine 2.5 years ago, but he started to talk about those things publicly again. He talked about it with Dale Earnhardt Jr.
I was 8 years old. This was a year before I started racing. We were at my sister's basketball tournament, and all of a sudden I hear a scream, like the worst scream that you'd want to hear. And I look over and I see my mom running out the door. And we had just found out my cousin was shot and killed by a police officer, unarmed. I was young. I didn't understand it. We lost a family member. I totally get it now. He was 18. They all went to a gas station here in Knoxville, Tennessee, and playing loud music. There's a whole crowd. Store clerk, who happened to be white, felt threatened that there was more African-Americans and that something bad was going to happen. So she called the cops. And the police officer had ordered my cousin Sean to put his hands up, and he did. And then that officer walked away, and he went to grab his phone to call his mom because he was scared and was shot and killed from the other police officer.
How did he first get into racing?
It started with his father. His father was a motorsports junkie. And growing up in Alabama and North Carolina with roots in Knoxville, Tennessee, he grew up going to short tracks, which for folks that don't know, it's like minor league baseball. It's, you know, every town has a little minor league baseball team somewhere within driving distance. And in motorsports, there have always been hundreds of what we call these little bull ring short tracks around the country. And the guys that race on those weekends, I mean, you're talking about guys that are hanging drywall and are plumbers during the week, and then they race on the weekends. And Bubba started doing that as a kid. You know, it's the story that we've learned since Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, and those guys came along. Jimmy Johnson, kids who started racing, you know, they're racing cars 10 years before they can drive an actual car on the street. And that was Bubba's background. And so he grew up going to the racetrack from the time he could walk, and he just loved it. I mean, there's nothing cooler than race cars. And it wasn't until later in his life, the first time he heard a racial slur, that he realized that he was any different than anyone else at the racetrack.
He is the first black racer with a full cup ride in NASCAR since 1973. Yeah. What is the legacy of other black drivers in the sport?
Well, Wendell Scott was that driver. And he started racing in the early 1960s and raced until the early 70s when, unfortunately, he had an injury that cut his career short. And Wendell Scott is in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. NASCAR's Drive for Diversity program has been around forever and has never gotten as much traction as they had wished. But Bubba Wallace was someone who was identified and put into that program early. And one of the advisors for that program was Wendell Scott Jr. And he and Bubba became close when Bubba was just a teenager. When Bubba Wallace won the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series at the time, it's the Camping World Truck Series now, think AAA baseball, he won an event at the Martinsville Speedway and drove a truck that was painted up like Wendell Scott's old baby blue car that he raced in the 1960s. And one of my favorite moments that I've ever covered was the family of Wendell Scott standing in victory lane at Martinsville with Bubba Wallace.
That was a great day. Great day. He jumped into my arms. He said, "Bro, we did. Why was everybody crying that day? The joy. Where did that come from? It came from Daddy."
When Wendell Scott, the only race he won as a Cup Series driver, he never received the trophy. He was in Jacksonville, Florida. They didn't want a picture of a black driver kissing a white beauty queen in victory lane when the race was over with. And it took decades for the Scott family to finally get that trophy. So for them to stand in victory lane with Bubba at Martinsville and finally get to experience a win, it was an incredible moment.
That story you told sort of addresses the question I'm about to ask, which is, why are they such anomalies in this sport, even to this day?
Well, you think about what the roots of stock car racing are. And this is a bunch of World War II veterans who came home and started running moonshine through the mountains of Georgia, North Carolina, and Virginia. This is a rough white crowd. The roots of NASCAR, you know, so firmly planted in the southeastern United States. Movie theaters are segregated, schools are segregated, restaurants are segregated, towns are segregated, and you know, people of color just weren't welcome at the racetrack, which is what makes what Wendell Scott did and when he did it, arriving in the garage, basically at the turn of the decade between the 50s and the 60s, is what it makes it so incredible.
Ryan, you mentioned that in the past, before this moment, Bubba wasn't always outspoken on issues of race and identity, but the two of you talked about it when you profiled him. What did he say to you?
Well, he just said that he was young. And what you find with racers that came out of the Drive for Diversity program is what they don't want is they don't want the perception that they were handed something someone else wasn't, simply because of what their background is. And for Bubba Wallace, he didn't make a big deal of it because he didn't want it to be a big deal. He wanted people to believe that he had earned his seat at the top level of stock car racing, and it had nothing to do with anything other than his abilities and his talent.
Well, he's certainly not hiding it now and seems to have stepped up and embraced that this is not only part of his story, but it goes beyond racing. What sort of role do you see him taking forward in sport?
Oh, I think that he has already taken NASCAR into corners of the American population that NASCAR has worked so hard to reach by all the right means. And unfortunately, because of some wrong means, Bubba Wallace has been given the ability to get more people to come to the racetrack. I mean, listen, I'm including you in this. I have received so many texts and phone calls and emails and DMs, whatever else, from colleagues who played in the NFL or who've never covered a race or played in the NBA or have played in the NHL who would have never given NASCAR a second glance. And guess what? They're asking me where they can buy Bubba Wallace apparel to wear. And now they're sitting and watching the Talladega race on a Monday afternoon.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Mina.
Excuse me, Mina Kimes? What you just said, Mina?
Oh, yeah. Hang on. Keep keep recording.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Mina Kimes.
Coming up, a global soccer star tells us how he felt he had to choose between the game he loved and who he is. Here's another story I want you to know. Thomas Beattie's soccer career has spanned decades. He has played all over the world, starting out in his home country of England, traveling to the US, Canada, and finally to Singapore, where he went on to win the Singapore Premier League title with Warriors FC. After suffering a serious injury in 2015 during a game, Beattie retired from soccer and began to pursue a successful career in business. And now, at the age of 33, he's made another decision. Coming out. Thomas Beattie's story is on ESPN.com today. Thomas, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Thomas, you started playing soccer very seriously at a very young age, around 9 years old. And I wanted to start there because I wanted to ask you, how did your talent and success so early on in soccer affect your ability to sort of live your life on your own terms?
I think when I was very young, it kind of, it was my escape. Everything I did, my energy, my focus, my passion was just for football. And that was all I needed. As I started to get a little bit older, I kind of started to comprehend that maybe I was a little bit different, and maybe the environment I grew up in was probably not conducive to me embracing or figuring that out. It kind of moved away from being something that protected me and a safe place to kind of something that it was almost a hindrance. So it's kind of the Jekyll and Hyde type of environment for me. As I started to get a little bit older, it kind of affected me in a different way, which I never really felt I could embrace. So yeah, I'm super grateful for my experiences in football, and it kind of, it's led me to where I am now and to be the person I am now. But yeah, I think there's parts of it which definitely became more difficult at the late stage of my career.
Because you felt like you had to choose between your sport and being yourself?
It's really intense football. It's very high pressure, and you kind of become married to the sport. And so I think having like the mental headspace to even comprehend that you might be different from the rest of your teammates, it can be a lot to go through. And I think just kind of feeling very lonely, like alone, not physically alone, but you almost feel alone, like, am I the only one who is like this? And so it kind of almost becomes a little bit debilitating. It's like the moment you start to accept that, it becomes really difficult to kind of do your job.
Did you ever feel like you could open up to your teammates?
Looking back now, I mean, I know I could have with some of them, but at the time it's super scary because you kind of, every part of your being from, you know, super young kind of tells you that this is something that is, you know, everybody else is not like this. And you kind of almost get brainwashed, you know, society kind of tells us these norms. And so it wasn't what I saw around me, you know, from everyone around me, coaches, management, owners, players, supporters, you know, you kind of almost feel like you are, you know, alone and different. And so it never really felt like I could kind of open up to anyone, really, not specifically just teammates. Yeah, I think it's just the fear of unknowing, right? We fear what we don't know. And so I think there's always that, how are my teammates going to react? How are the coaches going to react? The supporters, yeah, you know, being different is a blessing in some aspect, but it also is quite scary. And so I think that always was in the back of my mind of how that would be received.
Today, I think we think of society as being so much more open and accepting than even a few years ago, but the sports world still has so few examples of people coming out. As you wrote in your story, in soccer, Justin Fashanu came out in 1990. He later took his own life. Robbie Rogers, an American, came out famously in 2013. That's kind of it. Why do you think there are so few examples?
There's a few reasons. I think because it's just, you know, sport in general is quite a physical contact sport. So, you know, they require a lot of physicality. And I think society just kind of tells us that masculinity is linked to sexuality, which obviously we know is not true. But I think you kind of grow up and thinking that this is the case. And so, you know, I have to sacrifice a part of who I am to embrace another part of me. And so again, that's just, it's super scary because it's the unknown. You know, there's so little examples of people actually coming out during the career as well. You know, players' careers generally are quite short. So I think there's always that risk of, you know, would my contract be extended? Would it be terminated? Would other clubs want to sign me? Again, just the unknown.
So what led you to make the decision to come out now?
This is a process that I've been thinking about over the last 3 months. And so we started kind of, you know, marinating on this just after the new year. And for me, it was more about, you know, I've kind of, I'm at a stage of my life now where I'm super content with who I am and where I am. And I think it's a shame to kind of live in a world where we, you know, people might have to still sacrifice who they are. I mean, at the end of the day, we could be missing out on the next, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo or, you know, Lionel Messi. I always felt I had to sacrifice a piece of who I was. And I think it's important that, you know, we start to try and take steps forward as opposed to just kind of plodding along sideways. You know, there's a lot of movements happening at the moment, and which I, you know, I fully support. But I think that the theme of them is about inclusion and equality. And so I think this is just another one of them situations where, for me personally, I think I can do more, and I think I can use my voice for voiceless people. And I think I almost feel a little bit of an obligation to kind of find a purpose in that, for something that, for me, I struggled with massively when I was playing. I kind of want to use that and find purpose in that for myself, and hope that, you know, other people can resonate with that who might be going through the same thing.
How do you feel?
At the moment, it's still, you know, it's kind of liberating, but I'm still in that fearful / apprehensive kind of stage. But it is liberating. I'm ready to do this. I probably should have done this a long time ago. I know now, you know, the moment I kind of really accepted who I was, I kind of became powerful in the sense that I really understood myself. And so I think in finding that and really embracing in who I am, it's kind of added another layer of happiness to my life. So yeah, I'm kind of grateful for the process.
Thomas, what steps can soccer take? I don't know, soccer is a vague term, but how do you think the sport can become more inclusive going forward?
I think there's a few ways, you know, beyond creating a safe environment for equality and inclusion. I think it's just going to take really strong leadership from above. I think there's a systemic and institutional issue. So I think there really needs to be a real plan to address some of the challenges that athletes who are living in silence or living in the closet go through. I think there probably needs to be some kind of, you know, committee or group of people where players can kind of feel safe and kind of feel comfortable going to speak to about things that they might be feeling or going through. For me personally, that would have been something that probably would have helped if I was kind of still in that environment. It would have been great to kind of feel like there was somebody or a group of people I could privately go to in confidence and kind of speak about things that I was feeling or might have been experiencing at the time. But really, I just think there needs to be something there. And I think the LGBTQ community needs to have a seat at the table for that. And there needs to be a voice for somebody within that community who speaks on behalf of them. Like I said, at the moment, I don't think there really is any or enough support there.
Thanks so much, Thomas. And also, happy Pride Month.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.